Hi, this is James White once again for the Solution Series, brought to you by Corey'sDigs.com and the SolariReport.com, Solari.com. And we're delighted to be joined here today by two great guests. And before we continue, we'd just like to welcome Corey Lynn, who is the co-host, of course, of the Solution Series. Corey, always great to be with you.
It's great to be here.
It is.
I can't wait for this one. I'm super, super stoked about this one.
Well, before we actually get into the introductions for Jen and Matt, we just want to thank all of the great feedback that we've had from the people that watch the Solution Series. And, you know, it means really a lot to Corey and I, because this really is, we do this because we really do want to put solutions out for folks and empower people to be able to find solutions for themselves. So with that being said, I will introduce our guests. Our first guest is Jennifer Walters. She's a wife, a mom of two boys, and a registered nurse who left the mainstream medical industry after her oldest son was vaccine injured by his baby shots in 2008. She has dedicated her life to healing her son and helping others do the same, and she hosts the Health Series on Solari.com. Jennifer, welcome here today. And also with us, as you can see, is Matt Hale. He's been practicing law since 2004. He's a successful litigator who has focused his career in representing human beings who were harmed by others' negligent acts. For almost 20 years, Matt has successfully litigated complex injury claims, including medical malpractice claims against large medical systems and medical providers. He is often brought into cases by other attorneys who need additional expertise in medical injury claims, and he also writes articles for the Solari Report. Matt, welcome here. We appreciate both of you being here today with us on the Solution Series.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Corey, I'm going to turn it over to you, and I know you've got a lot of questions. So we just want to, first of all, thank our guests for being here. And Corey, go ahead. I'll send it over to you.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this because I think this is going to just be power-packed full of information. I spent a long time talking with both Matt and Jen about navigating the healthcare system, and they have so many key points to make. I'm hoping we can get to all of the points. And so the reason why we decided to do this actually is because Matt mentioned a study that recently came out on misdiagnosis. So Matt, I'm going to ask you first, if you can tell people, just so we understand, you know, to get us going on this, what this study is about and why it's important. We need to learn how to navigate the healthcare system.
Well, this was a study that was done by the government. And it came out and said every year in the United States, there are 7 million misdiagnoses in the emergency rooms throughout the country. And it leads to somewhere around 300,000 deaths and serious disability. So we've known since 2001, when Barbara Starfield and Johns Hopkins came out questioning whether American healthcare was the best in the world, that medical malpractice has been, or iatrogenic injury, which is injury from healthcare, has been the third leading cause of death in the United States. And this triggered me, especially in the context of our current climate, to make the conversation for people to know what to do when you're interfacing with a healthcare provider who may be screwing up your life and you don't know it. And too many people, in my experience over 20 years, just blindly trusted and had blind faith in these people in white coats who were literally, I mean, they're so far off the mark that by the time they get to me and my practice and having a lawsuit, they're devastated. They're dead. You know, right. I'm talking to the survivors, or they're dying and they know they're going to die. And those are it's heartbreaking stuff. So if we can come up with some solutions, some ways in which people can themselves find their diagnoses or find ways to lower their risk of being misdiagnosed, I think we can make a real impact for people just to survive healthcare.
Right. I agree. Isn't it? I think it was 1 out of 18 people that go to an ER are misdiagnosed
in some way. And then the study goes through and lists 15 conditions and the top that lead to horrific outcomes that are misdiagnosed a lot. And it's they list five that cause the most serious harms. And I'm going to look over and read these. Number one is a misdiagnosis of stroke, myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, aortic aneurysm or dissection. That's when your aorta, which is the largest vessel in your body, is basically blowing up, spinal cord compression and injury, and venous thromboembolism, which is a blood clot in the leg or somewhere in your body. These things are missed shockingly frequently. And one of the things the study points out is in terms of, for example, heart attack, some hospitals miss them 0% of the time. Other hospitals are missing as much as 29%, almost a third of the heart attacks coming through the door. So, you know, with stroke, for example, having litigated stroke cases, you have about 3 hours from the onset of symptoms to treatment before that injury becomes permanent, depending on the type of stroke. And really, the ability to diagnose that comes down to certain CT scans, MRI scans, other scans, and they don't happen.
Wow.
So, Matt, can I interject for a second and ask you a question? Is this something that has gotten worse? Because managed healthcare took over here, 20 years ago, I believe, and doctors were in and out, and you didn't get the same quality of healthcare that you did previously. Is this something, did it always used to be like this, or is this a trend that you're seeing? Do you have any numbers?
I think it's always been like this. I think it's always been, but I think it's gotten worse as these hospital systems have gotten bigger and more run by administrators than actual physicians. There's a lot of pressure now and I hear this insider talk in these big organizations about patient metrics and patient satisfaction surveys and how many patients that the doctors, you know, turning like tables at a restaurant. There's a lot of pressures on doctors to, and they tie it to their compensation. So, you know, I know doctors who are in systems where, you know, are they on this committee? Are they participating on that committee? Are these patient satisfaction surveys coming back? All this stuff that really doesn't have much to do with the practice of medicine, more to do with the business of medicine. And I think it leads to these problems. And then it's no one really addresses these in a serious way that I've seen. Now, there are doctors who are going to listen to this and they're going to be thrown a fit. And I think that's fine if you don't agree with what I'm saying, but let's talk about it because this isn't getting discussed. You can walk into an ER that's bad. And I've seen this in multiple ERs. You know, I practice mainly in Washington State, but I've seen it over and over again. The same ER has the same doctor making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And nothing seems to either A, boot that doctor out of practice, or B, you know, get this person to wake up and realize what they're doing is insane.
And then the people will continue to go back to that same ER, or if they have, or in the same case with doctors, they'll have problems with the doctors and they'll continue to go to them. And so I know you and I had discussed certain things that you said, you know, are really important. And I'm sure Jen will be able to add to this as well, that with the critical tests or diagnosis, blood tests or certain scans or certain things that you want to make sure that you do, you know, if you are concerned about something, especially if they're not suggesting to do it when you, whether it's an urgent care or an ER. So tell me a little bit about that, Matt. And then Jen, I want you to answer that as well with, as far as, you know, Go ahead, Matt.
let's take the example of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So I was shocked to learn many years ago, and I hope it's changed, that most ERs, and this was back in, you know, 2010-ish, 2008-ish, most ERs, when you walk into an ER, you go through first the financial part, because they want to make sure they get their your insurance information and all of that. And then you go to triage, and triage is where they're going to figure out on where you go in line. Mm-hmm. Most ERs didn't even have an EKG in their triage. So you walk in with chest pains and a heart attack. they can't plug you in triage to see what your heart rate, what your heartbeat looks like.
Wow.
They heart attacks can be diagnosed off of an EKG, and they can be diagnosed with blood tests, something called a troponin level. And troponin show up in your blood when you have cardiac damage happening. So you walk, we've had cases, these are old cases, but someone walks into the ER with a chest pain and they're found dead 3 hours later in the waiting room because nobody did anything. Wow. So, I mean, it can be to the point, especially with heart attack, where this is a serious, serious thing. They're not running blood tests. And you don't know, I don't know why this happens in some cases. The blood test will get ordered and that order never translates to action. Or the blood test gets ordered and then it's sitting down at the lab for an hour or two before they run it because it wasn't ordered stat or whatever other language the hospital tends to use for emergencies. So,
well, this is making me think about something I talked with Jen. They have, so I'm picturing you go in and let's say I went in and I said, you know what, I really feel like I need an EKG or I need a CT scan. And they say, well, no, we can't do that. We're going to do this instead. And I know, Jen, we were talking about like the EHR systems and CMS and where they go in and it basically tells them or assigns them to how it is they're able to treat you. So can you explain that a little bit, Jen?
Sure. So I experienced working as a nurse before there was the mandated, I think it was 2009, every single system had to go electronic health records, but it had to be the ones that the government told them to run. So CMS, Medicare has a preferred system. And so that's what they started using. When that happened, a lot of things changed. Before that, obviously, there were issues too, but you were still able to take notes, write down things, keep everything on what we call the bed sheet. You know, you could like fold out your chart and it would be as big as a bed sheet because you would have every single 12-hour shift and little tiny pieces all over it. And then you'd fold it back up and you could have that. It was really easy. You could look back and see what happened the day before the days, you know, so you could really have that, you know, three 12-hour shifts for your patient right in front of you. And you could know what was happening. Well, I think a huge problem happened when CMS came in, the Medicare system, the government, you know, all the data mining. They have these electronic health records and they not only tell the people what to do, but the quality and the metrics, the quality metrics or the quality measures, they're not about, did you die from a heart attack? Did you die when you came in with chest pain? They're about like one of the metrics I just was reading about some of the, and I called a few of my nursing friends. Let's see. One of them was depression. They want to search for depression. And if they find depression, you can get paid for that. So they, some of their metrics, like here's one, 90% of all patients or all people should have the flu shot. So that's another reason when you go into the ER and you're like, my chest is killing me. It's been killing me for 5 years and I don't know what's happening, but now it's really bad. And they'll say, okay, well, sit down. Let's take your blood pressure. Let's do everything. And they type it into the computer and they will turn to you and literally say, have you had your flu shot? So it's because it's a, and you're like, it's what? And then some of them say 90% should not have high blood pressure. And this is the number. And then, okay, so let's just say somebody, I know I'm all over the place, but I just want to explain this. So let's say somebody comes into the ER and they say, I broke my finger, right? You come in and it's not a life-threatening injury, but you broke your finger. Well, your blood pressure is going to be a little high. You've broken your finger. You just had to put your kids out in the, you know, wherever and with somebody that you don't know. You drive to the ER yourself with one hand. You come there and you're just like, I broke my finger. So we take your blood pressure and it's high. So now the computer or the electronic health records or the quality measures tell us that we not only have to, you know, do something about your finger, but now we have to get your blood pressure lower. So, and we have to show that we've done that. Otherwise, we're not getting paid. And I don't mean that I'm doing this. This is the reason I left the system. I went back in 2011 after I'd been off for a while, and I started working again. And the hit of not being able to touch my patient was strong. I was doing 60, 70% of my time sitting and clicking stuff on a computer. I wasn't holding their hand. I wasn't checking anything. I wasn't looking at their poop. I wasn't doing anything that I'm supposed to do, because most of it was filling it out and figuring out, okay, you know, what shots, what this, what that, and then, you know, having them fill out all their HIPAA forms and, you know, all that stuff. It just, it's overwhelming. So basically it's just all about quality measures, and they don't care. It's not the people. The people who work there care.
Right. Are these same systems being implemented if you go into an urgent care or a doctor's office?
Oh, they're just everywhere.
So we can finish kind of laying the groundwork before
they're really everywhere. They are everywhere, okay. Except doctors that have opted out of the Medicare system. And there's a whole bunch of them out there. And there's also surgery centers that have, there's urgent care clinics, there's, all kinds of different doctors that have opted out of this. And then they have their own electronic health system, electronic health records, that they don't need to be on the ones that do the quality measures and all the crazy stuff. But they have to, they're entirely off of Medicare. So they are direct pay, cash only. But they also find, I found to be very, very affordable. And if you have no money, they figure out how to help you. You know, it's something called charity. We've been doing it for years.
To finish this off, to lay the groundwork, as Corey says, how, just to finalize it here, how do the drug companies, this big pharma, work into all this? Because I know they got to have a component in this somehow, somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I was just reading this article. It was from 2019. I kept it because it had such a great, you know, title to it: Data Mining, Artificial Intelligence, and the Angels of Death. I'm like, ooh, my kind of article. this is from 2019. And everybody's using all their Fitbits and all of their stuff, you know, all their technology to track their health. Well, Google acquired that. And then they also started looking at their electronic health records intelligence program of Transcribe Medical. And then they also worked that into a horrific palliative care and hospice education training act. And this isn't Google that did it, but the government and Google, everybody works together on it. And they did a, who ran that? I think it was the AWS of Amazon. They have, so everybody's kind of gotten together, and they've got this Transcribe Medical, and then they also have their pill pack. And that's where Big Pharma comes in. So I'm just using this as an example. Take Amazon. So for all of their employees, they have their pharmacy supply with their pill pack. You guys know what pill pack is from Amazon, right? Have you heard about it?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So let's just say that you have, like, my sister, she's mentally challenged, and she has seizures from a birth injury. So she's in her 60s. So she has maybe six different meds, and they all keep her alive. They're actually ones that work for her. So she could send in all of her prescriptions to PillPack on Amazon, and they would divide up all the prescriptions and put them into little square plastic sheets that say Monday, 3 o'clock, you know, things like that. So it kind of organizes it for you. Something that we've been doing for years as humans, we can organize our own pills into like a thing. But anyway, they do it. And then they also have this Transcribe Health, where you walk into your doctor's office, right, or the clinics that Amazon owns, which they're spreading it everywhere now, but this was in 2019. And you start talking to your doctor, oh my God, I'm going to kill my kid. He spilled pizza everywhere. That is getting transcribed into your record. Like everything you say, it's going into your electronic health records. And on top of that, you've got Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan Chase, they're all backing that up. So I think that's where pharmacy comes in. I mean, Big Pharma, is that they're all just kind of working together with the government and the Medicare system, it seems to me, they're all part of the quality measures. Because if a quality measure is 90% of the human race gets a flu shot, how is that not Big Pharma?
You know? Right.
Anyway.
So were you going to say something, James?
No.
Matt, you want to comment?
I was going to throw in on top of that so the old saying a little law professor of mine had is, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah,
that's great. It transcribes to the doctors who, when all you have is a prescription pad, everything looks like a pill.
That's right. I mean, yes.
You know, it depends on the training and experience that human being who's talking to you about whatever in the ER has, and whatever, you know, else is on his mind, you know, maybe his golf game or.
Yeah. Or just the fact that he's having to do 60% of his time is just filling this out because he got in trouble the last time when he said, oh, no, I don't want you to be in that. And I'm not backing up the doctor and saying, oh, no, they're not making mistakes. It's awful. Everybody's making mistakes. And I think a lot of it has to do with the electronic health records and the way that they're taught in schools now. So you're not taught to think. You're taught from the very beginning, medicine, fix this, and you have to follow these measures in order to get paid. And if you don't all of a sudden break off and go off and start your own practice and do something good, then you're just in that wheel. You know what I mean? It's the whole system. Right. It's poison from the ground up. But anyway.
I don't mean to keep jumping in, but a mentor of mine once said, beware the odds medicine. It's when you can sit down and repeat to your doctor and say, odds are you have. There's no science behind that. It's a guess as to what you have. Right. And so odds are you have the flu, or odds, you know, and or odds are you just have heartburn, and they send you with some antacids, and then 2 days later you drop dead of a heart attack. Yep. So beware the odds medicine. If you can repeat what the doctor said and said, odds are I have, and they haven't proven it, then the brain should start to engage of either I need to find a new place or I need to think this through, because, you know, the odds are they're wrong. So, right. And then one other thing that I'm just hearing of now in this, at least in the Seattle area, the staffing levels have gotten so bad in emergency departments that people are sitting for 2 and 3 hours in the ambulances because they can't transfer care to the ED because there aren't enough beds.
Well, I don't think it's the beds as much as that there's not enough people to run those beds. Because, you know, they run like hotels. When I was training in cardiac at the VA, I remember they would shut off 2 wings. And then they would say, okay, we can only accept 9 patients today. And I'm like looking at this huge thing going, I could take a nap in like 24 beds. What are you talking about? You know, but that's just kind of how that was way back when, you know, and that's kind of how they run, like hotels. That's what I discovered when I work in hospitals.
Wow.
Which is frightening.
So you've got MDs, osteopaths. Sorry, Corey.
Go ahead.
You have MDs, osteopaths, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, allopathic medicine, holistic medicine. How do you choose the right doctor, the right one to go to? I know that holistic medicine is making sort of it's been around for a long time, but I think it's becoming more and more mainstream than it ever has been. And I think largely because I think people don't have lost confidence in the establishment medical system. What do you think about all that, about all these different choices that people have? There's many, many different choices. And we know the osteopathic is more, not so much, maybe more help having a person help themselves, or more like manipulating the spine and things like that with osteopathic as opposed to MDs. But do you have any comments on any of that? Both of you certainly could comment on it if you like.
Oh, I absolutely love that we have all of the choices, right? We just have to be careful, because I remember Dr. Tenpenny, who's an osteopath. I remember her saying, gosh, you know, I think that she was like disinvited to some lecture or something because of her vaccine stance. It's like, you're osteopaths, what's going on, you know? So, and they were like osteopath people that disinvited her. I forget the whole story, but the other thing we have to watch for is it's not so much the type of doctor, because you can choose whomever you'd like. And if you're going to a homeopath, you're probably going to not be in the middle of a hospital system, right? But we all have to know that someday, I mean, hopefully this will never happen, but somebody's going to have a heart attack or get hit by a bus or, you know, whatever, break their finger, and they'll need some urgent care. So that's where I think that we're going to come in and focus on who doesn't have Big Brother, right, looking over them with these electronic health records? And I'm not saying that you walk into the office and they're like scribing things on stone. You know, they're used, you know, they don't have to go back to the 60s, but they can opt out of the Medicare system. And so there's a place, let's see, it's called The Wedge, jointhewedge.com. And a nurse runs cchfreedom.org. I think I sent you guys the links. It's the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And they have this thing where it's actual medical doctors that you can find that don't use the Medicare system. So they're not going to be under that CMS that says, oh yeah, we want to help you and we think that something's wrong with you, but you know, so let's say that we want to go to a medical doctor, or we want to go to a DO or a homeopath or naturopath. Just ask them, hey, do you guys take Medicare? Do you, you know, are you under government control? You know, and then you kind of find out from there. I think that's what we need to start looking at, is it's not so much the type of doctor, because that's personal choice, but I think we need to see where they're, electronics, their data sharing, what are all of those things happening? You know, do they have a scribe and a digital scribe sitting in the room, which is their phone, and do they put it on their, using their scribe app? So then it transcribes everything you say. So when you're talking about, you're making a joke to the doctor about, well, you know, I could take care of that by just sitting in my bathtub with a bottle of wine, and you're kidding. I'm not going to go sit in a bathtub with a bottle of wine. Everybody knows I drink outside with my bottle of wine. I'm kidding.
Of course, but, me too. You know, I was going to say the same thing.
What am I thinking? But no, it's frightening. So I think that it's more about finding the right medical practice and seeing if we can stay out of it. And then knowing the ways that we can work the system that's controlled when we have an emergency, and possibly, because I know the Wedge people over the Citizens Council for Health Freedom and the American Physicians and Surgeons, they wrote great books, and they've been around since the 40s fighting the AMA. They want to create hospitals where we don't have this mess. So I think that, you know, we need to find small surgery centers more, and we start pouring our finances into that, pouring our focus into that instead of our HMO plan. I think that that's where we'll be able to make a change.
Okay, so what I've been trying to spit out.
I'm sorry, okay. Just tell me to shut up. Just throw something at me.
No. Right. No, everything you guys are saying is great, but I just want to kind of give like an outline for people so they understand where we're going. First, we're going to have a huge list of resources underneath the commentary of this. So, and we also have resources that Jen's put together in PDF format for subscribers that they'll be able to download. And basically what we want to cover is between the two of you, you both shared wonderful information with me, you know, before we started this. And it's several things. For one, it's the what's happening with when you go into these places, whether it's an urgent care, an ER, or a doctor, how you talk with them, you know, making sure you say certain things or you don't say certain things, how that information is being recorded, what forms you want to fill out and what you don't want to fill out, getting into a system and a structure that works for your family where everyone kind of sits down and says, okay, these are, you know, each individual's health needs. These are the types of physicians we're going to need. These are the medicines we need or the natural medicines we need, and kind of coming up with a plan from there. And then building into, okay, so now let's look at what's affordable and do we need insurance? And if we do, or maybe it's the shareable, the group type plans, that we have resources for that under here as well. And so it's like putting together sort of a whole new system of how to navigate this atrocity that's been going on for a long time. And so I want to go back to Matt for a minute, because we talked a lot about how people are kind of caught up in this, you know, doctors are gods and they're the authorities and we just listen and we don't ask enough questions and we just trust. And so that's one big thing that you know, I think people need to develop a healthy sense of skepticism, but then also on what to be careful to say or not to say, or and especially when they get into, has your child or you gotten the COVID jab yet, and that type of thing. So if you can talk on that a little bit, Matt, that would be great.
So yeah, I've had my moments because I'm a hothead lawyer sometimes. I'll just tell a brief story about my grandpa, who had a fall in his house and had 72 stitches right across his head. So he's in the ER. By the time we get there, they've got him dressed. He's still bleeding from his stitches into his eye. And I asked the nurse, this was earlier on in my career when I wasn't as refined. I asked the nurse, who was this tall guy, about 6'4", did they do a CT scan? Because I had had by that point at least two or three cases where someone fell, hit their head on a hard object, didn't get a CT scan at the ER, went home and died of a brain bleed. Mm. So the nurse then turns to me and gets within my face. I can feel his hot breath. He's screaming at me about how the doctor didn't think it was necessary. It was none of my business. And so I escalated, he escalated. Finally, a social worker came in, and I was able to eventually talk to the ER doctor. And when I talked to her, I said, well, have you done a CT scan? And she says to me, well, no, I didn't think it was necessary. He's oriented to date and time, and he says falling's normal for him. And so I looked at her and I said, well, then can you make sure and guarantee in writing that he doesn't have a subdural hematoma? And her eyes got big, and she said, we'll get a CT scan right away. What I learned from that experience was, one, sometimes you don't just shut up and take it.
Oh, no.
On the other side of it, you be nice. You have to be nice to these people, and you have to be kind, because they deal with combative. They deal with combative all the time. If you can turn it to a positive, kind, nice encounter, you're likely to get them on your side. And that's important. And it's what Jennifer said, and understanding the pressures they have will help you to not get instantly annoyed when they're asking you about your vaccine status, you know, and your palms touching your elbow. It's a way to just relax as much as you can and turn this into a positive interaction. I had another ER experience, and I made my wife drive me clear downtown to the hospital. And the doctor said I smelled nice. I was his best smelling patient, because all he dealt with was homeless people who had had various traumatic events. So it makes a difference how you present. Mm-hmm. And then remember, when they chart, they're not charting for you. They're charting for them and to cover their butts. So when you say, if they ask you, well, have you been drinking? They're not going to write patient wasn't drinking. They're going to write patient denies drinking.
Yep.
And the response to that is, well, I don't know if you really weren't drinking or not. So the charting, and especially now with electronic health records, and I think it's why it's critical in your community to understand the various medical systems. So you need to know, for example, in Seattle, south of Seattle is controlled by Franciscan Health, which is CHD Franciscan out of Colorado. The urgent cares are owned, most of which, by these big medical facilities, and they all share records. So once you have a misdiagnosis in your record, it just gets repeated and repeated and repeated. The only thing you can do, if you have the time and the ability, is to get out of that system until you can get a new medical record that shows you don't have that, and maybe some diagnostic proof, which means you have to maybe get copies of your of all the diagnostic stuff that happens. Now, they'll send it to you in your MyChart record, which is like the Reader's Digest version of your record, which is pasted all over it, all the diagnostic codes and everything else. Now you're handing that to a new doctor who's going to look at it and read it for the diagnostic codes, and you're not getting a fresh look. You're getting somebody looking at you through the same lens as what the prior provider did. So you want to actually find out where the labs are and get copies of the labs, even if you have to scratch that stuff out, so you get a fresh look. Because one doctor will say, your blood levels are, they're not that bad. You know, they're not that bad. Right. But in reality, another doctor is going to say, oh my God, we need to do something here. Right?
Is there any advantage to keeping your own personal health record, just marking down these certain things that you wake up in the morning, you get a fever, you mark that down? I mean, how valid would that be, your own personal observations, or are they going to always rule with what the doctor says?
That's an interesting question, because the lawyer in me hates diaries when they show up in lawsuits, and it's like, why did you write that? But I don't think it can. I think it can be helpful to keep track if you have a provider who's willing to take the 5 or 10 minutes to listen to you.
Now, what about when you're asked if you or your child has received the COVID jab? How do either of you can answer this, recommend answering that? Because we know they're documenting all of this. So,
well, they already know. You guys know that. Like, everybody already knows. The person sitting there asking you, they don't know, but they're supposed to ask you. But everybody already knows, because they have a system. Every single person who got the shot got on an app. And so all of that information's there, and they can just match that up with the driver's licenses or whatever they can find, you know, the Social Security, or, I mean, you know, they can go into a bunch of different things. I'm pretty sure they already know that we didn't get it, but the hospital itself, what I do to stay out of any trouble, because, you know, I'm in California, which is, you know, I mean, it's really bad here. Help me. It's bad. I go in and they'll say, is your son up to date? Like, you know, he fell the other day and hurt his elbow. And I was just like, oh, I better get an x-ray. Oh, I don't want to go to that stupid urgent care, but I had to, because the x-ray place that I usually pay cash for wasn't open. And so we went down and I said, can you just check it? And they said, has he had all the shots? And I'm like, oh yeah, we are completely compliant with everything he needs. And that's all I said. And then when they said, oh, does he have the specific COVID shot? I just told them, no, he didn't have the COVID shot, because I don't want to be marked down somewhere that he had a COVID shot or anything. We're just going to, I'll take that hit. But out here, you get in trouble for not having a Hep B. You know, you get in trouble for not having a flu. I mean, you know, if you don't have the childhood schedule, like my children were kicked out of school in 2015. With SB 277. So I give as little information as possible is what I do.
Right. Oh, when I go into places, I don't, you know, like my laptop fell on my foot last year and broke it. And, and so I'm going into, what do you call them? I just spaced the foot doctor,
podiatrist.
Yes. And I look at these forms. It's not like I go to them often. And I look at these forms and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not, you know, I don't enter my Social Security. I don't do my medical history. It's not necessary for what I'm going for. So I only give the pertinent information, which brings me to HIPAA. Jen, you say that people should not sign that form. It is not a privacy form. So tell us about that.
Oh, HIPAA. I have so much information on that, and I will try to be quiet about it. I won't talk too much about it. But anyway, basically, HIPAA is not about privacy. The P in HIPAA, I bet everybody thought that must stand for privacy, but it stands for portability, right? Mm. So I had a couple of things that I wanted to make sure to add in. And, you know, I always blank, so I've got to get my notes. Nurses take notes.
So what do you mean by it's a portability?
Okay. Form. So portability is, thank you. My brain shut off. Now it's back on. So portability for HIPAA. Well, basically what happened was right about Obamacare, et cetera, this kicked in, and people think that this means that you're private. So, like, you know, when you have to go to the drugstore and you're standing 10 feet behind them, so you don't hear what they're talking about, you're thinking, oh, HIPAA, it's private. Or you call and you say, oh, my grandma, I want to get her flowers. I don't know what room she's in. I'm sorry, we can't give you that information to deliver the flowers. And you're thinking, oh, privacy, that's good. HIPAA. Those are just kind of like fake phony things that they put in there to make it look good. But basically, portability, it's a portability act. It means that you don't have to sign it, or you can sign it. It's going to happen anyway. When you go in, they're just acknowledging the HIPAA form, just as they're telling you, hey, all your stuff is going to get shared with all of these people. I mean, it goes all the way down to like the CDC. It's like thousands of things that can be shared with. And I think somebody figured out that it's going to be like, and 70,000 more of like, or seven, it might be seven or 70. I don't know. My memory's bad, but it's a lot of people and like businesses and companies that shouldn't even see any of your data, but it means that your data, all of your health records, all of your information is now portable to be seen by anybody that is involved in your care or sometimes isn't involved in your care.
So Matt, if I went in and refused to sign HIPAA forms at places and then later find out that my information was shared, what does that look like?
Well, there's no private right of action under HIPAA. None.
Yep.
Each state has its own privacy laws and disclosure laws.
Right.
Okay.
And so, but then again, if the disclosure is required by law, then there's nothing you can do about it.
Yep. So by not signing it doesn't really do anything because it's still going to be shared.
Correct.
Right.
Well, especially if you have health insurance, for example, you've already released your information to them.
Right.
So the health insurance, if you have a medical payments insurance, they have a right to get your records. So I guess they have their own sharing databases too.
Right. And so if these are local, you know, state laws, federal laws, where they're able to share this information, then why bother have this form anyways?
It's an administrative requirement to make you feel good. Right. I signed this form. Great. Now, this is our privacy policies. This is how we protect your information. And when you read, you know, Jennifer's right. It goes to whatever. I mean, the health insurance companies and the insurance companies in large, they get it all and it's there. And they share it in their databases and they know full well where you've been and what you've done.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, since 2010, 2.2 million entities, not people, but entities now have access to your data because of HIPAA. And only 700,000 of those are the ones that you expect to have your data. So no. Doctors, labs, x-rays, health plans, but the rest are like business associates.
Okay, so Jen, what if I was to move into, like, you have a really great system going, and of course, you have the benefit of being a nurse for your family. But that said, it's still a really great system that could work for everyone. They're just not going to have necessarily the in-home skill benefit, added benefit that you have. So if someone were to go through some of the physicians through the networks that you've talked about with me and that we're including in the resources, is it the same there? Is your information going to be shared out to, you know, multiple databases if they're able to stay in with those, you know, types of doctors and medical professionals?
Yeah, they've actually signed a form and they're paying a they sign a form to opt out of Medicare, right? And they're not accepting any health insurance plans. So they're just working as a doctor with their Hippocratic oath, and you come into their office and your stuff stays with them. Unless they are like weird and tell you, hey, get on an app and put all your stuff on an app. You know, that's why I'm a little worried about the telehealth companies that are coming out, even though I'm really happy and thrilled that people have telehealth because it's easy to get to. I'm just concerned that now they're putting them on apps and you're doing your blood pressure on an app and an appity, app, appity, app, 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 app. And so I just think like we need to have more home visits, you know, or hands on the patients, but that's just me.
Now, what is the main group that we were talking about where people could go in and they could look for physicians in their states? In their local areas.
Right. So there's the American Association for Physicians and Surgeons, the aapsonline.org, and you can go under resources, patients, and you'll see, and I gave you the link, but you can check and see if there's any doctors that belong to that place, because they're usually physicians that sign up for that, they're independent, right? Okay. They but some of them still accept Medicare. And, and by the way, even if you've opted out of Medicare, if there's an emergency situation, the doctor can still bill Medicare. You know, so if you're going to a surgery suite that only accepts cash, but then an emergency happens, I think that they can still bill it. It's some sort of weird thing, but anyway. But yeah, the AAPS, you can find a doctor in your state, or they sometimes still have the Medicare place, right? And they accept the health sharing insurance. But then the Wedge, they're a little more strict. Jointhewedge.com. They have it that there's no government reporting, cash based, no outside interference, and you basically can find your doctor in your state. And they've got a lot of them. I mean, I've got a few. Now, remember, there's not that many doctors in the world. You know, like when you look at like the amount of pediatricians in, you know, you think really there's only a few thousand, you know, because it's not. I mean, I'm talking the United States. I probably shouldn't say the world, but the planet. Right. And I just found that, you know, there was a good amount. There probably should be more. But I think the more we get out of our system and we support them and we find out, like Citizens Counter for Health Freedom or AAPS, hey, how can we help you instead of paying Starbucks or putting more money into something? Let's all get into like a health share plan, right? Which is half as much as a ACA. And then you don't have to pay any penalties on your taxes or anything for it because it's accepted. And then you're paying less and you can choose whatever doctor you want that's in that particular system, or go out and see whether you can get shared from that, or just find a practice under the Wedge or AAPS and pay them cash for their services. I mean, if you really think about it, if you keep yourself healthy, you're only going to go out in when you need one.
Right. Or they can help
you maintain your health. Oh yeah, you negotiate.
Always negotiate with everything in life.
Well, okay. So I've been out of health insurance for years. I think when my son was vaccine injured, I found that every single thing that actually helped him get better with his brain injuries and his therapies and everything then I had to barter and do cash because nothing was covered by health insurance. Nothing.
Right.
Nothing that helped.
So I
pulled out of my health insurance. My husband, I, everybody, we're out. And I did health share for a while, and I have a AAA policy that in case I'm driving in a car and or I'm on a bus or any transportation type thing and it blows up or I get hit by, you know, or I'm in an accident, all of my medical will be covered under that. Ah. So it's kind of like a, you know, it's not it really
like a,
that.
Is it like a catastrophic if it's like in a vehicle related?
Yes, but it's got to be, you know, that you're, because that, when am I really going to, you know, watch, I get hit by a bus sitting here now, you know, but usually, you know, people when I worked in the ER, people were always on some sort of transportation when they would, you know, come in for the big things, right? So we have the big things covered, but then the rest of it, we just figure it out. So my son needed an MRI. I called around to 17 different MRI places and I negotiated like I was buying a Toyota.
Right.
And I found the best price. And when they heard I was paying cash, they were like, oh yeah. And even labs, I go to mymedlab.com online and I figure out what labs I want. You can call and talk to them. You can ask a doctor can give you a prescription for all the labs that you want. And then you just kind of go through them, or you can order your own labs and the doctor for that company will order them. And I found that they were a lot cheaper. So let's just say that the lab, my insurance was telling me, the one that I dropped out of a long time ago for my son, that his viral panel was going to be $3,000 if I didn't use their insurance. Wow. And I thought, well, I got to figure something out. It ended up being $300.
Wow.
So I don't know why the discrepancies, because I didn't, it's not like I went to Vinny and he took the blood, you know, like in some back alley. I actually just went into a regular blood place, handed them anyway.
Let's say someone goes off, because I think telling, you know, if you tell older people, look, just ditch your Medicare plan.
Oh,
so what options, like, how does that work as far as, because I know you can get, like, my folks are on Medicare, but they also have a backup plan that picks up the difference. And so how would you work? If you were to get off Medicare, how would you work something like that?
Well, my sister, I don't have her off her Medicare, and I don't have my uncle off his Medicare either. We have it in case of hospitalizations or big things or whatever. But we found a doctor that does a concierge type service. And so he will bill Medicare for certain things, but he doesn't for others because he's in his 80s, she's in his 60s with a lot of stuff wrong. So I kind of monitor it. And this doctor is, we pay him cash for a concierge service. So he's not reporting to Medicare. He's not part of Medicare. But if she needs Medicare because she goes in the hospital, that's when that part kicks in.
Right.
And he will monitor her status because she's been put in the hospital. Does that make sense?
Okay.
But I don't have elder, like you can have a health share plan and be on Medicare, but you can still go to see any doctor you want that doesn't take Medicare and tell them, and just don't bill Medicare. Do you know what I'm saying? Like you can stay on Medicare, but I'm not talking about the HMO plans. Okay. I'm talking about just the ones that your Social Security, I mean, I would love it if people could choose to not have their Social Security pay Medicare and they could choose to just be out of it completely.
Right.
You know, because then they could decide on their own health. Like instead of that money going to that, now your money would go to what you really want.
Right.
You know? But you can, I'm not telling people to dump their insurance. I'm just saying I did because it wasn't helping what I, and then I found this great place where I just bargain and figure things out and it actually saves me money. And I do pay the penalty except for like 1 year. I think Donald Trump took the penalty away, but I paid.
Is that penalty back?
I think it's not back this year. I think it's back for next year. Something like that. I think the penalty is coming back, I heard. So
if, I'm I happy to pay the damn penalty, the idiots. I'm not actually going to pay it, but
yeah. Yeah. That's sometimes they might not catch it on taxes. So, but it's like $800 or something like that. So let's just say if I were to get in a plan right now from the ACA, the Obamacare, it would be probably about $3,000 a month for my family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even a gold plan.
Wow.
And I wouldn't be able to choose my doctor and it would be a high deductible. And so let's just say that I go into we went into the ER. He had a few things, whatever. I said, no, I'm cash. They said, oh, okay. Well, you need to choose then everything that you're getting. And I'm like, exactly. So I said, no, I don't want your x-ray machine because that's pricey. I said, I'm going to just take it across the street to this x-ray machine. Because, you know, in the hospital center, you can do a bunch. And I was calling that. And then the nurse came to me and said, okay, well, we are not going to give him any of this or give him any of that, you know, because of this, this, and this. And my bill wasn't that bad. And I just went down and I made like a payment plan.
Right.
Like you're buying a pair of shoes.
Yep. Yep. All right. So Matt, I have a few questions for you pertaining to things like power of attorney for parents in a, you know, hospital scenario. Also, you and I talked about private autopsy because autopsies are becoming a thing where, you know, the doctor has to order them and in some cases won't, but people can get private autopsies. And then the other thing is a way of getting out of hospice, because we talked about that. So I think those would be three good points to cover.
One thing I want to circle back to this conversation about privacy.
Yeah.
I want people to just assume that their records, no matter where they go, are not private.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Here's why. Okay. If you get rear-ended, your entire medical history becomes relevant.
Right.
And if you're going to have to sue this insurance company, they're going to get everything. Mm-hmm. And guess what? If you don't tell them, they're going to find out. I don't care. If I had a magic wand, I would wave it and say no more social media, because people don't just go to the ER anymore. You know, they're taking selfies and they're talking about their interaction on Facebook or whatever. And all that information that's sitting there waiting for some insurance defense lawyer, some government lawyer, some social worker, somebody from CPS to get and to get from you. So even if you're going to some doctor who handwrites his notes, they have to keep those notes. There's laws in both state and federal laws requiring those notes. And if those notes will show up in some lawsuit somewhere if you end up getting rear-ended or if you end up having, you know, something like that. And so be very careful, because assuming that you're going to walk into a doctor's office, spill everything in your life, and it's not going to show up later, that's, I mean, you don't have the right to remain silent in a medical office, but...
On that point, I just want to throw in, people should not be when they're asked about mental health or anxiety or depression, because this is becoming a big push right now. You know, unless they're actually there for anxiety disorder or something, don't divulge that information or agree to fill out these forms that are starting to circulate. That's a trap.
Yeah, right. don't fill out any of those forms. In fact, that's a quality measure more than, you know, and just what Matt said. Don't tell them anything that you don't have to. And when he said you write to remain silent, yes, you're basically like, what did I say, Corey? I said that it's kind of like when you pull up. I remember my first time I was dating my husband, he was driving in the car and we had to go through a DUI checkpoint, right?
Right.
He never rolled down his window. And I sat there going, I am so going to marry this guy because he is right on it. Because he was, the cop was like knocking on the window. And my husband's like, thanks, officer. Don't need to roll down my window. Have a nice day. And the officer let him go. So be very specific, like write everything down that you want to know from your doctor. So I make a list. Mm-hmm. My throat hurts, my butt itches, and my head hurts, you know, and that's it. And you can make a little small talk in the front office or whatever, you know, with the secretary, and you can be very nice and helpful, but do not divulge anything, because even if you fill out one of those questionnaires, I know the one about the drinking, mm-hmm. you know, the one where they say, how many drinks do you have a week? And you're just thinking to yourself, if you only knew. I'm just kidding. Now that's going to go on. Oh, great. I'm through. I got to hire Matt.
We took my daughter to the doctor several years back, and the doctor came in and said, do you have guns in your home? And I'm like, that's not important information for you to know. What does that have anything to do with my daughter's health?
It's because it's a quality measure. It is a quality measure. It's going on the thing. And then they're going to use it at some point. They're pulling it out, I think, the insurance companies, to say, oh, you need a kidney transplant now? Well, it seems to me that you've been drinking one drink a month for 20 years. So we're not giving you a kidney, because if they can do that with the COVID shot, they're going to do that with you saying that you have a couple drinks. So the answer is no to everything. And you don't even have to refuse it. You can just say, nope, don't drink. And even if it says denies drinking, it's better than saying that you have one that they can add. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's, yeah. And it is bad. All of our data is out there completely. It's why
Matt, you try to stay healthy.
Yeah. Well, I did to what you said. What you said is just a classic, doctor, that's none of your business, right?
Yeah.
That's going to start a combative relationship with this doctor.
Yeah.
And if you're sitting in the hospital setting with your child, and you've now gotten into a verbal fight or started an escalation, let's just say you've started escalating with this doctor, man, they got a lot of power all of a sudden.
Oh, he didn't like it. He didn't like it. He didn't like that.
So you just kindly say, well, you know, thank you for asking. I'd rather not answer that. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So back to the, let's see.
Okay. Sorry.
You were attorney and the hospice and the autopsies. If we can just go over those quickly.
So, there's a lot of work on Solaria about healthcare proxies and powers of attorney. Mm. You need somebody with medical decision-making authority, but you need somebody on the same page with some cojones. The last thing you want is to have somebody come in and just be like, oh yes, doctor, whatever you say, doctor, sure, doctor.
Right.
That's going to lead you down a path to hell. And literally, my other grandfather, just really quick story, same ER doctor time and time again, and he was having TIAs, put him on a medication. Medication caused Parkinson-like symptoms. Next thing you know, grandpa's getting loopy. They're putting him in a mental facility all because of the medication. And finally, my uncle did the research, said this medication's causing this, had to fight like hell to get him off of it. And guess what? They go back to the same ER with the same doctor who wants to start him down the exact same path again.
Wow.
So at that point, he was able to stand up and say no. And you need somebody who can say no, and you need somebody who's educated. So if you end up in an emergency situation where you're in the hospital and they're treating you and they, and you have somebody who can give consent, you need somebody who can, who's smart enough to say, oh, no, no COVID shots, or, you know, to work with these doctors and not make the situation worse for you, because so often they're going to be pressured into making rash decisions. And so that's important on that. Private autopsies, there are used in cases, experts, retired coroners, and pathologists who can do autopsies. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can get, if somebody dies in the hospital, you can ask for that to be done. Sometimes the counties just don't have time, or they're understaffed, underbudgeted. The last I checked, it ranged the gambit on pricing between about $2,500 and $10,000. But if you have somebody who dies because of something and you want to know why, you want to push to have an autopsy done, and, you know, don't just let them race them to the embalmer or to, when they burn you instead of bury you. You can find somebody in your community, and if you call your local medical malpractice lawyer, they'll probably know where to go.
Yeah, because like you were saying, you want to make sure you get what was it? You want certain documentation and slides or images or something from the actual.
Here's what we're seeing in the autopsies that are being done in relation to the vaccine deaths. They're taking slides, tissue samples, stains, all this stuff that's way beyond a normal autopsy.
Right.
And so that's happening because this pathologist is doing it, and or those pathologists are doing it. It's not. And so I wouldn't count on your county coroner to do that thorough of an analysis.
Right.
If that makes sense. Because what happens all the time, it happens a lot in my experience with wrongful death cases, is if you don't establish a cause of death, a documented scientific cause of death, you've got a problem, because they'll come up with lightning strikes from Jehovah. They'll come up with anything that sticks to beat your case.
Right.
People say, well, I don't want to sue. I'm not that type of person. Trust me, when you lose the main breadwinner of the family with children left behind, you know, that's your only, sometimes that's the only way families get enough money to move on.
Right.
So don't just throw that possibility out the door, like you're never going to go down that road.
Right. Now, as far as, I just thought this was an interesting one. As far as hospice, so if someone's in a hospital and they're dying and they get to the point of hospice, the hospital sort of has certain levels of power and control over that. And you were talking about, you know, how you kind of get out of that and get someone home, or can you speak to that?
This is where you need to know the various people that work in hospitals. So the social worker in the hospital is a powerful individual, and they have social workers for different aspects of the hospital. For us, my mom she was dying of cancer. It was advanced. And so she wanted to get out of there, and it became a fight because she had good insurance to get her onto hospice. And so I ended up having to go to three different social workers to finally get one to get on the phone to find a program. So hospice is, it's like you've now entered into a legally defined term. You are dying. There is no cure for you. All curative care is going to stop, and we're going to move you where you want to go to have a good death. Essentially, that's the ideal behind it. So you can go home at that point. Now, I talked to people just anecdotally who had people who had been in the hospital with COVID, and they were dying, and so they pushed for hospice. They were able to get them home and get them treatment and actually turn them around.
Nice.
So hospice is something where, you know, when because the hospitals will say it's time to pull the plug.
So basically, kind of reverse of what I was saying, it's if they're in the hospital and say the hospital determines, oh, they're dying, and from COVID, allegedly, and they're not going to want to release them, you're saying, unless you say, well, we're going to do hospice care, so we're going to get them out of the hospital. Is that accurate?
Yeah, kind of, because it comes to a point where the hospital's telling you, you know, there's not going to be much more we can do. Right. There's nothing more we can do. There has to be...
They need to know there's care, though, if you...
Right. So it's the hospital determining that there's no opportunity to cure anymore.
Right.
That's hospice. So there's no more curative care. And you go into an entirely different system. Mm-hmm. You go into a system designed for comfort, for, you know, maybe not being in the hospital setting, going right. home, all of a sudden things, different tools become available. Nurses visit your house. And right. so you're not under that. You're not in that building with all of its administrative regulations and computers and things telling people what and how to do their job.
Where you can actually get your loved one the treatment they might need.
Right.
But for curative, they're not going to pay for anything that will help them at all. Do you know what I mean? Like if they want to get out of hospice, that's what's hard. Yes, you can get other people and you can kind of work around it. But ever since there was you've seen that Palliative Care and Hospice Education Training Act that they put in, right? Because, you know, palliative care, I didn't mean to interrupt, but a palliative care, it is a cash a cow right now. I mean, I have friends that are hospice nurse forever. They've been hospice nurses. And they're just like, wow, everybody's on hospice now. Because wow. palliative care has become the new term and there's a bunch of funding for it. And they've made these educations for this. It's like they can't wait to get us all, you know, dead. And then once, because the Medicare will not pay for any curative treatment or medications, and they won't pay for emergency room visits unless the hospice team arranged it or someone decides it's not related to the hospice diagnosis. So my mom died in 2019 and I fought like hell for her. I was, you know, that's all I did. I basically put my battle axe on every morning and would go down and try to take care of her and make sure that she was getting everything she needed. Everything they were doing to her was making her sicker and everything was worse. And it was just a spiral at 87, right? Nothing I could do. And I tried my very, very best, but she loved her doctor and she loved her HMO and she loved her flu shots. And I don't know what else to do. You know what I mean? Right. Like I can't boss my mom around because she was the queen bee. So, but I did my very best, but I know that once she got placed in palliative care program, which was 5 years before she died, getting any sort of treatment for wound care, anything, I had to beg the hospital system, the hospice people, to write that it had nothing to do with her hospice diagnosis, and then I could get that treatment paid for.
Interesting.
Anyway, it's just another loop. Sorry, go ahead. It's really awful. It's hard to jump those.
Everything we're talking about is so fact specific and so nuanced that you know, you have to take a step back and look at your situation and say, okay, what's going on here? Because, you know, for us, when my mom was dying and there was, you know, she had small cell lung cancer.
Oh, God.
She didn't even get breathing treatments until she was in hospice. It was the worst thing. I mean, it was, you know, and she didn't want to go to, I was going nuts because I hated the hospital and that she went to anyway. And I drive a very nice truck because of the hospital, but it was just so frustrating to watch somebody suffering in a hospital because of incompetence.
Right.
You know? And then you get into, and you're right, they will not pay for curative anything. And so that would be cash out of your pocket at that point. But, you know, there's a point when you're going to have to, you're going to have to part with some dollars. And I'm amazed at how many people decide they would rather die than spend their money. There's so many people that are, it's shocking.
Well, I think that this COVID thing is going to change that because there's so many vaccine injured and they're going to notice that nothing's covered. Like getting, everybody that I meet, all my nurses, my friends that were nurses that are now injured from the vaccine, they're like, oh, so any treatment that helps me isn't covered. I'm like, yeah, you kind of been watching me do that since 2008 with my son. I'm sorry, you know? And so that's, I think if we invest in it now, you know, try to create you know, because there's still going to be data everywhere. You know that they're gathering the data. And Corey, you wrote the book. You know what they're doing with this. It's got your national patient ID now and all this stuff that we've got to fight. You know,
right.
Just we can't keep Rand Paul in and, you know, forever. He's the one keeping it out. And Ron Paul was the one keeping the national patient ID from going forward and, you know, for funding it. And then now we've got Rand fighting it. We've got to just get that taken off. We've got so many things we have to work on to get our data out of people. But all we do is keep loading crap into our phone and wearing our Fitbits, you know, and we've right. got to do that. And, you know, listening to Matt, I mean, it there's a whole nother thing that we've got to think about, like, you know, anyway.
Well, and you had a great idea. You had a great idea, Jen, as far as for nurses. Start, you know, if you want to talk about that briefly, just, you know, about, because I think that would be fantastic for people and nurses.
Yeah. Well, the American Frontline Nurses, I interviewed her on the health series, Nicole. Nurse Nicole Sirotek, she started the advice nurse line. It's on their website. I sent you the link, but you can actually get a nurse advocate and talk to them. You could do a Zoom with her, or you can call them on the phone and actually have a real person that you're talking to. And then they've been through COVID actually getting in touch with the people, showing people how to escalate through the hospital to get the right people to talk to. And they've been rescuing people from the hospital. They've been coming home to, you know, house to house, helping people. And so that's there that she's starting. And then I've been working as a community nurse since forever. And I just volunteer this part of my life because, you know, I can't work full time anywhere anymore. So, you know, I'm doing design work. I'm doing this and doing, you know, I would dig ditches. You know, that's what you have to do because I'm not going to work in the hospital system. But I go around to people's homes and I help doctors. I'm their person that smells, sees, touches. I'm with the patient. And so I might be on the phone with the doctor, not using an app because, you know, you don't want to do the privacy thing unless it's a specific HIPAA portability act privacy thing. But, you know, I'll be on the phone with the doctor and I'll be able to tell him, you know, he doesn't look right. His eyes are kind of yellow and I think his sugars are off because he's not answering the questions. He's oriented, but I don't know. That's barely oriented, you know? And so, okay, bring him in, or, oh, let's do this. Or I'll go get an IV bag and I'll just bring it to his house. It's that home health care that's not part of hospice and not part of palliative. It's just a community nurse that can come around and not community like the globalists call them, community nurses. Cause now I think they're coming up like robot nurses or something, but you know, just if we could all, and it doesn't even have to be a nurse, it could be doctors, it could be anybody, but if everybody would volunteer their time and just find out who needs something and then find out what medicines they're on, go through that, see if that's causing their problems. Just like you said, my dad had the same thing. He was put on a medicine to help with something and it gave him a Parkinsonian effect and they killed him with all the stuff that they put him through with Parkinson's when he didn't have Parkinson's. And there was nothing I could do. You can do everything, but if they believe the doctors, I'm just the daughter. You know what I mean? So anyway.
So with the nurse, you talk about volunteering, but couldn't this be something where it builds on a local level to where they're actually working for doctors and getting paid? Or
yeah, I mean, I was thinking, you know, these wedge doctors, these private doctors, I mean, I just work for all these doctors. Every once in a while, they'll, you know, throw something at me or whatever, but I don't take money for it because I don't have time. I can't be on a schedule. But yeah, you could definitely make a career out of it. You know, you could, you know, work for a doctor because my nursing license does nutritional counseling. You know, I can work under a doctor to help them. You know, I do my own nursing process. So I have my own nurse's diagnosis and then there's medical diagnoses. And basically I just go and I help them read a lab, understand what the lab was. And then I call the doctor and we talk about it. And then, you know, we kind of all discuss it and I'm there to help the patient figure out what questions to ask the doctor. So yeah, I mean,
we could
start like a thing.
Now, both of you have told me books that you think everyone needs to have in their homes. So, Matt, what was the book or books that you had shared with me?
I think there's this really great book called The Unvaccinated Child. has lots of remedies, talks, and lots of advice on what to do with various ailments. I think if you go and find a used physician's desk reference, there are these huge, and they're called PDRs. And what they are is they are the list of every medication that a doctor is going to prescribe. And what's great is you can flip through there, you can find the medication, and you can see for yourself what the side effects are, what was found. It talks about studies. I mean, the vaccines are included in there. It's just a wonderful resource. Brand new, they're really expensive, but a couple of years old, they're still going to have good information and be like $30. It's just worth it to have because, so you know, the doctors aren't looking at them. They're not. They're just, ooh, I'm going to write this out. You know, odds are you have this, odds are this will help. And then you're going to come back with symptoms and they're going to say, odds are this will help. And next thing you know, you're on this train of medications, each of them is causing your symptoms. So those two books are great. I'm drawing a blank as to other ones. There's just a whole litany of books you can get on
natural. Yeah, I actually have one. It's super thick. On medical emergencies at home if you can't get to a hospital and whatnot, and they actually have little diagrams and visuals showing you how to do wraps and different things, and I think that's really important to have on hand. And then Jen, I know you probably have several books that you could tell people they should have in their home.
Oh yeah, I have a ton. Let's see, I've got a couple. I just got this new one that I started reading. I really like it. It's written by a doctor. It's Dr. Sam Bailey, but she found a doctor that had written this like in the 20s, and it's got diet, living habits, and divine thinking. It's called Terrain Therapy. It's her newest book. It's really great. I love it. I'm going to try to get her on the health series to talk about it. Well, we'll see. She'll be like, Jen, who? And then one of my favorites is Big Brother in the Exam Room. It's written by Nurse Twyla, and she's part of that. This will give you kind of the overview of what's happening, when it happened. Another one is this little baby book you can get. It's called Common Sense Medicine by AAPS. It's one of the doctors in Jeff Danby, but it's the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. I sent you the link so you can get it, but it's like really quick read. But it kind of goes over restoring the patient-physician relationship. And this, I think, those books, and then I had a homeopathic book that I don't have on me right now. It's probably somewhere in my house with like pages. It was for acute care homeopathy. So like if you have bleeding or if you have a headache or if you have something, it'll help you with like the quick stuff. And you can look it up kind of like first aid, but it's homeopathy, bee stings and different things like that. And then my nurse's drug guide, the PDR is the same type of thing. I find the nurse's drug guide to be really great. You can get, they come in all different kinds. You can get like new, old, whatever. They're really cool. So they go through the dosing, which is important because a lot of people just read like, I'm going to give this much, not that I give Tylenol to my kids, but let's just say in a blue moon, I'd have to give like an Advil or something to them. You read the back of it and you're just like, you're giving how much to a skinny 11-year-old? Because it says, they're 11. Let's give them this much. Well, The nurse's drug guide shows you how to dose to weight. So milligram per kilogram. And it's just a real simple math. If I can do it. But yeah, and those are my favorite books, I think.
So I have one final question for you guys. And James, if you have something else you want to throw in there, feel free. But I wanted to ask you guys, for people to keep their house in order, so in addition to sitting down with their family and individually kind of writing up, what their health needs are and developing a plan, finding the right doctors and insurance versus no insurance, how should one keep their house in order from a medical standpoint and a legal standpoint? What is just some good things people should do? Go ahead, Jen. We'll start with you.
Okay. I was waiting. I'm like, I don't want to be like, anyway. Okay. So basically, you get your necessary medications, keep extra ones. So you can always ask your doctor for another, an extra prescription You'll pay cash for it. Your insurance probably won't cover it. And you can find like coupon programs and different things like that. And you can kind of build up like a stock. So like my sister, she has seizure medications that are really important. So I always keep at least 3 to 6 months on hand. And I don't worry so much about expiration dates, you know, if they kind of start to go off, but I try to change them out and I keep like an emergency stash of that. And then I try to get off of as many medications as possible. So like if you can find an herb that'll take care of it instead. I know a lot of people were using ivermectin and different things like that. And yeah, I saw them do a lot of great things, but I also work with doctors that just used, you know, silver, hydrogen peroxide, you know, vitamin C, D, zinc, you know, all those things. And they worked as well. So, you know, it's, you have ivermectin on hand, but then also have a big bottle of silver, you know, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, just whatever kind of first aid kit. And that book sounds wonderful that you have. I'd love the title of that, because you knowing how to splint things, knowing how to get, you know, so that way you're not running into the emergency room and you're so freaked out that you're screaming at the person. You've actually handled it to a certain point. Like when my kid cut himself, I was able to butterfly, well, I'm a nurse, but I was able to butterfly the wound. And we went in and I stayed calm, because even when it's your kid, even if you're a nurse, sometimes your training can go out the window. But, you know, just kind of have things prepared. And that way you have it all ready. And then I also have an ER plan just in case of emergency. Know where you're going to go. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important. And maybe do a drive-by, you know, go in, not a real drive-by. Oh my God. Here we go. What am I saying? I need a drink. No, I don't drink. Oh, what am I saying?
Objection.
Okay. So I need Matt. Okay. Go visit the hospital and see what kind of doctors work there. Find the doctor you like that's on staff, you know, kind of know their schedule. I don't know, but that's what I do. I kind of have an idea about where I would take my husband if he fell off his ladder. You know, right. Every time he gets on a ladder, I go to myself, all right, if he were to fall off that ladder, you know, I kind of have a plan.
Right, so. Right. I found the book. So the book I have is called The Survival Medicine Handbook. Essential guide for when help is not on the way. So I have the fourth edition, and it's by Joseph Alton, who's a MD, and Amy Alton, who's an APRN. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty thick. It's a big book. All right, Matt, what do you suggest?
I was taking some notes. First of all, with your healthcare, know what's going on. No blind faith. Okay, if you're going to have a surgical procedure, you better know the risks. In fact, write them down so you have a list. I can't tell you how many tragic cases are, you know, mom got her tubes tied and she died because she didn't know that anytime a doctor operates on you, they can hurt another organ, okay? And that leads to your death. So really know what the risks of your procedure are and communicate that with the person who's helping you through it. Any sort of surgery has risks, so know it. Drill it in, ask your doctor, ask. Because when you end up in the ER with symptoms, you can have that and you can tell them, I just had abdominal surgery and this is how I feel. And at least have a chance of them finding it, ruling it out. We talked earlier about MDs, DOs, all, you know, naturopaths, chiropractors, they all have different skills and different tools. Mm-hmm. So now they're not all one size fits all. So, you know, like Jennifer said, if somebody falls off a ladder, you're not going to take them for herbs, right?
No.
You want to take them where they can put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So at the same time, you don't want to go to an orthopedic surgeon right away because your knee hurts, because they have one tool. So read and learn. Get yourself educated on this stuff, because I think you can avoid a lot of interaction if you don't read and learn. One note I wrote is shut up. Mind your privacy.
Yes, keep that window rolled up.
Yeah, I mean, you don't, we have an adversarial system legally speaking, and that means that people can push and you need to know when it's time to draw the line. So forms, all these things that they want you to fill out, less is more most of the time, you know, and just be nice if you get pushed on it, just be nice, stay friendly. And then, you know, with your healthcare proxies, with your powers of attorney, make sure they're on the same page as you, because the last thing you want is someone who's going to agree to all this stuff because the doctor says so. And you know, we all know what happens. So that's would be my
summation. That made me think of one thing I forgot to mention that we were all on the same page with is the networks. Everywhere you go, you know, they're in these insurance group networks. So you've got your primary doctor and they're sending you off to this doctor. And then you have to go back to the primary and they're sending you to the next one. And it's frustrating. And it more and more, it seems like, because I've talked with a lot of people and it seems like, you know, they'll send you over, like you brought up, Jen, how someone doesn't know how to read their labs or their tests. And they can't get the doctor on the phone and 4 days have gone by and they're looking in my chart and they're seeing this and they're freaking out going, what does this mean? You know, and it's just, I don't know, the system has just gotten more and more broken apart. And so I think we all agreed like these networks that have to be under one insurance group with the primary is not necessarily a great way to go. So
yeah, it might be a $5 copay, but it's, you know, not necessarily great. So my uncle, I just got him out of his 89. He got out of his Medicare HMO, right? And then now he's in a Medicare with a Part G or something in case of like something horrible happening, getting hit by a bus and he goes to the hospital or he has a heart attack or something like that. And then he belongs to a concierge doctor where he pays a little bit per month. And then the doctor is his full time, which is nice because then he can ask and call and talk to them. The doctor's visits are an hour and a half, maybe.
Wow.
Like that's a typical doctor's visit for them. And so there are doctors out there. Is it really pricey? It's not cheap, but this one's not expensive. And I'm telling you, doctors are willing to work with you because I'm broke. And I was able to get into really good doctors throughout this thing for my son because I would offer them things. I would say, hey, I can work for you. I can do medical writing. I can do research. I can answer the phones. I can sweep the floor. I can get coffee, you know, right. All that kind of stuff. And so we would barter different things. So.
Right. Matt, any thoughts?
One thing I want to add to that, there's the insurance referral networks and then there's the doctor's referral networks. So I've noticed patterns in my own meandering experience that certain large hospital systems that own multiple hospitals refer from hospital to hospital, but you don't get outside the system. So what that can mean is that sometimes they don't offer the best trauma care or they don't offer the best whatever, but you're going to stay in that hospital system to keep the business in that system. So understand that, like we said earlier, the urgent care clinics might be owned by some of these big systems. You're getting referred into that system. You're not getting referred to the best. You're right. Getting referred as part of a business plan. And so be aware of that. Be aware that the doctor may be referring you to somebody who is in that doctor's network, right? Not yours. So do some research. Do you know, and that's why it's great to know a local nurse who has friends who can call and find out about Dr. So-and-so, because sometimes their information is a lot different than the smiling picture on the website.
Right. So I think the moral to the story is everyone really needs to focus on taking health into their own hands and really, you know, fitness, diet, herbs, you know, natural medicines, do as much as you can to keep healthy, but then come up with a good game plan for yourself and your family that works the best for your health situation. And, you know, figuring out the most affordable scenario that works for you as well.
Yeah.
James, do you have anything to add?
No, that pretty much covers everything. We covered a lot. This is one of the longer interviews that we've done. It's great. We appreciate you both being here. Anything that you think that's vital that we didn't cover here before we try to wind things down? I think you pretty much answered his last couple of questions. You answered the important stuff to do. One quick question. When I was in Michigan, they had a small clinic there that the doctor had just had. I think they charged $100 a month for whether you either had services or not. It was like a local clinic. And they just had a group of, in their network, I don't know, 100 or 200 patients, but all of them paid in every month, whether they came or not. And that was sort of like an in-home health plan. Is that popular? That's are they doing that still?
Yeah, that's concierge service is kind of what that sounds like to me. That's what I do to have this geriatric doctor for my elders in my family. And then we did that a little bit with one of our pediatricians. It was like $60 a month, just because I needed that to be able to sign forms and different things like that. But we have chiropractors instead of pediatricians for actual health. But concierge are great. And then you've got the Wedge, Join the Wedge. They're actual doctors that got out of the Medicare system. So they're not in it at all. And then, which is another, it's a positive. And then you have the individual doctors that just have their own, they aren't in the big hospital systems. You know, they put out their shingle, and that's the AAPS physician. So.
Yeah, crazy. It comes down in closing. It comes down to what you had just mentioned earlier. Basically, they want you in their system, and if you take your health into your own hands, you can certainly save money and probably get better health care, quite honestly. Because as you were mentioning, Matt, they want to keep you in. They want to, you know, you're an ATM, sadly, these days, and they want to keep continuing to cash out. And if you can break that cycle, you may actually have better health and save you some money. I appreciate both of you being here. Corey, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to catch here before we
I think we got it all. Anything we didn't, we have an extensive resource list that's going to be going underneath the commentary. And like I said, for subscribers, we have a few PDFs that Jen put together as well with additional tips. So lots of good information from both of you, Jen and Matt. Super appreciate it, and appreciate the work you're doing in your own lives and helping people, and as well as with Solari.
Oh, cool.
Thank you. Indeed. Indeed. Well, we're at the, once again, at the end of one of the Solution Series podcasts here. We do appreciate you joining us here. We want to thank Jennifer Walters and Matt Hale for being here with us today. If you like what you see here, if you're just catching a clip of this, you can find out more at Corey'sDigs.com or Solari.com. And we appreciate you looking in. Until next time, this is James White for the Solution Series, saying bye now.